Good evening. I trust you've had a good day. It's the Lord's Day, and that's always good. We're sorry that we have some out with sickness, and we hope that they'll get better soon, and that nobody else gets sick. That may be asking for too much, because that's our common lot in this world, but nevertheless, it doesn't hurt for us to hope for that, and even to ask God's blessings on us to keep us healthy and keep us well. Periodically, with no particular regularity, we spend a Sunday night talking about some random subjects that often are unrelated to each other. And a lot of times, some of them are hard questions, at least for me, and some of them require academic pursuits, academic discussion of certain things, whether they're taught or not in the Bible. But tonight we want to do a little bit something different and talk about some things that have to do more with personal attitudes about things. And one of the things we want to talk about is when strength is a disadvantage. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, the Apostle Paul said, and he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Well, that kind of sounds contradictory in some ways, some of those things do. Normally, we think of our own ability as an advantage. That's how we normally think. Whatever we think we need to do, we'd rather be able to do it than not be able to. I think everybody feels that way. We cringe at the thought of personal insufficiency, that there's some things that we'd really like to do and we can't do them. And sometimes we lose the ability to do certain things we used to be able to do, and we don't like that insufficiency because of the things we used to be able to do, and we find ourselves coming up short. But in our relationship to God and in our work in His kingdom, there's a sense in which our own personal strength can be a disadvantage. That's what Paul was talking about in this passage here. And so natural strength is often as great a handicap as a natural weakness is. And whenever there's something that we can do and we know that we can do it, we're tempted to believe that our strength is our own. But when we do that, we tend to leave God out of the picture, and that it's our ability, and we've learned how to do this thing and so forth. What was that old song? Do you need any help? I can handle this job all by myself. That kind of thing. We begin to feel independent and self-sufficient. And we're kind of getting in dangerous territory when we start thinking like that. And our need for God kind of recedes into the background when that happens. And it's strange but true, but the more we think of the things God has made us able to do, the less we pay attention to the God who made us able to do them. So that's something we have to work on continually. And the devil's right there, whichever way we turn. He's got something else to offer to us. So while personal strength is a good thing, if we get to trusting in that, we start leaving God out. We start trusting in our personal strength. So to Paul, God said, "My strength is made perfect in weakness." And Paul, like all of us, probably enjoyed days when he felt adequate and he felt sufficient to do what he had to be done. But in truth, God could do a great deal more with Paul on the other days, and when Paul felt weak rather than strong. So the Bible tells us that God allowed Paul to have a thorn in the flesh. I don't fully understand all that's involved in that, because while God allowed it, the Bible calls it a messenger of Satan. So this thorn in the flesh, whatever it was a messenger of Satan. When you read the whole context there of 2 Corinthians chapter 12, we understand why God allowed this thorn in the flesh. Paul had just been caught up to the third heaven. Remember that? And the Bible says he heard words that were unspeakable, that a man was not allowed to utter. And because of that, lest he be exalted overmuch, lest he begin to think too highly of himself because of this unique experience that he had, that so far as we know, nobody but Enoch and Elijah had experienced before, that because of that, God allowed this thorn in the flesh to keep him humble, because it could go to his head. And so God allowed this thorn in the flesh to multiply the number of days when he would feel weak. So Paul looked at that weakness, physical weakness, whatever it was, of something in the flesh, as a spiritual blessing. Now, it may be hard for us to arrive at that kind of thinking, but that's kind of what he's saying here. And there would be days when he was most conscious of his dependence on God's help, and therefore the days of his greatest usefulness. And so when a thorn in the flesh makes it painful, it's something he was constantly aware of. And when that appears on our own lives, and our natural response is to want to get away as quickly as we can and as possible. And yet if it's God's will for us to continue with that thorn in the flesh, our attitude needs to be the same as Paul's. We need to figure out some way to look on the bright side of that and turn it into a spiritual blessing if it's a physical malady. And Paul said, I take pleasure in infirmities, for when I am weak, then I am strong. That's hard for us to work on. It's hard for me to work on. And yet we've got to try to think like Paul, because the Lord endorsed Paul's thinking. Here's a quote by one commentator. He said, God uses chronic pain and weakness, along with other afflictions, as his chisel for sculpting our lives. Felt weakness deepens our dependence on Christ for strength each day. The weaker we feel, the harder we lean. And the harder we lean, the stronger we grow spiritually, even while our bodies waste away. To live with your thorn, whatever it is, uncomplainingly, that is sweet, patient, and free in heart to love and help others, even though every day you feel weak, is true sanctification. So it kind of seems like a contradiction, but somehow we need to arrive at that kind of thing of Paul, and it'll make our burden here on earth a lot lighter and a lot easier to bear. Another thing we want to talk about is, what is our most important problem? In Matthew 16, verse 26, Jesus said, for what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Well, difficulties are not hard to find. In fact, they kind of have a way of finding us. And the average person's life presents a thorny thicket of problems that have to be dealt with. You've got your list, and I've got mine. And indeed, on some days, it seems we do a little more than run from one problem to the next, trying to put fires out. We can hardly get one fire put out before another one breaks out somewhere else. You've had those days. I have to. But out of all the things that we need fixing, which one needs fixing the most? Which one? Which issue in life is the main issue? Sometimes it gets lost. We've got a thing out there on the bulletin board says, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And we need to do that. We've got to prioritize our problems. So one measure of our spiritual maturity, and even our earthly maturity, is the way that we prioritize our problems. And it helps some if you quit looking at them as problems and look at them as challenges instead of problems. But often we use those terms interchangeably, but I think looking at them as a challenge makes it more challenging to us, and we don't have that dark cloud hanging over us all the time. Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom. That's the first thing. And the immature person may give the most attention to the problems that are really of secondary importance. They're not on that main list. They're not the main thing. And the more mature person sees things that matters the most and gives them the primary attention that they deserve. And so if the way we spend our time and the problems we choose to work on are any indication, how mature can we say we are, really and truly? So, Anybody who's read the New Testament is going to know that it takes a definite purpose, and it takes a definite position on the question of what's important and what's of secondary importance, what's not quite as important. And Jesus put it in the form of a question: for what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Our main problem is our broken relationship with God. And as long as that problem goes unfixed, we're pathetic and we're profitless creatures on the earth. Even if we're able to fix every other problem in the world, won't matter what else we can fix. And millions of people would say amen to the importance of God. They would agree mentally with that. But these same people spend most of their time working on issues that really don't belong on that main list of the most important things. And they work on things other than their relationship with God. And so our schedules simply don't support the claim that spiritual concern are number one in our lives, if we really looked at our schedules. And so we rush through our day, accomplishing little more than rearranging deck chairs on a sinking ship, that kind of thing, and not really not accomplishing anything important. And so that daily challenge that confronts each one of us is not only to see what most needs to be worked on, but to keep that concern at the center and focus of our attention. That's difficult, not impossible, but in the end, it's going to be evident what was the most urgent thing that mattered to claim our attention and which things were inconsequential. We've got to learn those, and before it's too late, we need to stop our frantic fixing of things out there and work on the things in here. So we need to do that and try to accomplish that as best we can. Another subject I'd like to talk to you tonight is doing things that you don't want to do. There are a lot of things on that list that we don't want to do. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27, "But I buffet my body," or "I discipline my body," some translations say, "and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should become disqualified," or "be rejected," or "be a castaway," different translations on that. So it's healthy to do something every day that we really don't want to do, but that really needs to be done. And we keep putting it on the back burner. We keep procrastinating with it. And we need to do that just for the exercise, because we need that kind of exercise. There's a great benefit in practicing the art of self-discipline, and that's engaging in it regularly. Doing it regularly for the sake of building our mental muscles. And so when Paul said that he disciplined his body and brought it into subjection, he spoke of something that requires a bit of unpleasantness. That's unpleasant from time to time. By its very nature, training requires us to get out of our comfort zone. And that's why we have a problem with exercise. It's hard to stay in that routine. It's easy to break it. If we never call upon our muscles to do anything more than what they want to do, then we never gain the ability to do anything more than that. It's just that simple. And so we ought to look for opportunities to do things that we don't want to do, that need to be done. And it's one good way that we can grow. We grow in doing that. Have you ever watched somebody exercising? It's a lot easier to watch than it is to do it. And you can watch people do it on TV or go to the gym and watch them do it. But many of the bodily movements which strength and agility are developed would be ridiculous if we did them for any other reason other than training or exercise. And I think you know what I mean by that. Some of the things people do, take setups, for example. There's only one reason to do setups that I know of, and that's to make your abdominal muscles do things that they don't want to do. No one would ever do it for any other reason except training, practice, exercise, discipline. What other reason would you do them? Well, when you do setups, you're demonstrating that you grasp one of life's great principles, and that is there's value in doing things that you don't want to do. things that that we don't want to be, that don't want to be done. And nothing is more valuable than having our faculties, our mental and spiritual as well as physical, trained and ready to respond to important needs. But having faculties that are going to respond to important needs is not something that happens overnight. It doesn't happen that way, and it doesn't happen without any effort. Doesn't happen that way either. So when the big test of life comes along, we won't be ready for them if we haven't been training for them before then. So we need to do that. Train beforehand. So today there's something unpleasant, some little duty that, well, that's an annoying thing. I just wish it would go away, and we're procrastinating about it. Do it because you don't want to. Do it because you don't want to. Take that little opportunity to put the flesh in its place and teach your body to take orders from its, from the spirit, from your spirit. And someday you'll be mighty glad you did that. Another subject I'd like to talk about is commitment and joy. One of the disadvantages of a complex, fast-paced society is, like ours, that we get entangled in so many different concerns that there's so little time or inclination to be deeply involved in any one of them. In other words, we say we've got too many fish to fry, too many irons in the fire, all those expressions we use to say we've just got our plates full. We can't do any more. We've got more than we can handle. And so we don't delve deeply into things. We dabble at them. And Dwight Moody, the guy that has the university named after him up in Chicago, Moody Bible Institute, he said, give me a person who says this one thing I do and not these 50 things I dabble in. Well, we kind of get in that situation, don't we? We're dabbling in a lot of things but not doing anything well. And so trying to do too much often keeps us from doing our best at anything. But we do mediocre things at a lot of things, and none of them well. So to make matters worse, the very spirit of our age militates against a person making a commitment, any kind of serious commitments to things. And I think part of that comes from being overwhelmed with junk mail and people calling, trying to get you to buy something, telemarketers, that kind of thing, so that we kind of get gun-shy. We don't want to make a commitment to anything because there are too many people out there trying to bait us and hook us, and so we get gun-shy. To make matters worse, our age kind of contributes to that. And so we're aware of the possibility of getting into something that we can't get out of. And like a timeshare or something like that. Some of those things that we get involved in, boy, I wish I hadn't got in that. So we have two distinct tendencies that when they're coupled together, they make a dangerous situation. And one of them is that we're frantically busy, but at the same time, we don't want to get involved. You see the difference? We get busy, but we don't want to get involved. We suffer at once from a surplus of activity and a shortage of commitment to any one of them. And you've been there, and I've been there, and our hectic fiddling with this and that and the other puts us right there next to the fellow who describes himself as being deeply superficial. We don't want to be that. We want to be genuine. We want to do things well. And so it's little wonder that we get so little out of what we do. And we just feel exhausted all the time. And we've gotten the wise advice of our grandparents who told us, you get out of something what you put into it. How many times did we hear that growing up? You get out of something what you put into it. They were telling us that, some things that hold true for all of life's endeavors. And that is that commitment and joy are partners. We've got to learn to find joy out of doing those things that we're committed to. And when we stand at a distance from the work and the relationships that ought to be dear to us, we forfeit the fulfillment that's available to us. And we miss that. When when we dig in and we truly get involved and we risk vulnerability, we risk that of being genuinely committed to something, and we find that life is a storehouse of satisfaction. So when you really get committed to something and you're seeing benefit come from that, you can find joy in that. But it's hard to do that when we've spread ourselves so thin of things that we don't do any of them well, but we're involved in a lot of things. Consider, for example, our marriages. Think about that. In so many days, we avoid any real commitment. Sometimes people don't want to be too committed, and they treat their marriages as open, disposable relationships. We read about that in magazines and various offices and things like that. And we ought not be surprised if they provide very little gratification. And so do we spend time nurturing our marriages? If so, then they're going to grow into something rich. They're going to be something great and rewarding, relationships. But a lot of people treat their marriages the same way they do these other things. They dabble at them. Marriage will never fulfill the expectancies of those who only dabble with it. It's a commitment. So is Christianity. And that's the second thing we want to talk about. And that's our involvement in the congregation of which we're a member. Do we attend only the services that are convenient and we participate only in the work that suits us? Do we criticize what they are doing? If so, there's not going to be any real sense of joy. We ought to have joy in a local congregation that comes from our membership in the local church. And I see people have that. I see some that don't. We'll receive little benefit from what God means to be a rewarding relationship. He knew what he was doing when he had congregations established. We need that togetherness. And if we refuse to make the commitment, then we're not going to have it. And church is going to be a chore, and it's going to be one of those things that we endure rather than enjoy. And that brings us to our devotion to the Lord himself. Do we pray regularly? Do we study the scriptures haphazardly and reduce religion to just intellectual pursuits, intellectual academic debate, and that kind of thing? That's easy to do. Do we limit ourselves to routine formal expressions of worship and praise, and we can just go through the motions and we can call it off by rote? Do we fail to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind? You notice how many times the word our, O-U-R, occurs in that phrase? Four times. Thou shalt love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our mind. We're going to find it spiritually to be the least interesting facet of our lives if we don't love with all of our hearts and all of our being. If we don't do that. But if, on the other hand, we have the courage to pursue God with a risk-it-all commitment, we're going to discover that the joy of the Lord is our strength, like Nehemiah said in chapter 8 and verse 10. The joy of the Lord is our strength. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29 and verse 13. So, it's a risk, but it's a risk worth taking. And so, from that standpoint, we might consider it dangerous to our lifestyle to care deeply about important matters. We'd rather dabble in a whole lot of things and not excel in any of them. And so when we put our heart into something, when we give it all we've got and we put ourselves in a position to be inconvenienced and disappointed and frustrated and possibly even hurt, that's the risk. But if we take the easy way out, we avoid those serious commitments in life, we don't want to get too involved, we want to just kind of be mediocre at this, we doom ourselves to an impoverished existence, and we don't achieve what the Lord wants us to achieve. And sooner or later, the person who sows sparingly is going to find that he also reaps sparingly. That's God's rule of sowing and reaping. And that happens. So, I want to exhort each of us, including myself, to care deeply about God and without delay do two things. And one of them is to commit yourself passionately to the worship of God and to involve yourself tirelessly in the work of God. Be involved. Doing things. Not just showing up, but doing things. It will cost you. It may cost you dearly. In fact, it'll cost you everything you ever thought was yours, but you'll be richer for risking the great investment that you've made. And joy will be the reward of your commitment. And so joy and commitment can go together. They should go together. They shouldn't be antagonistic to each other. And having risked all else for the joy of God, you'll be able to say with Paul, "For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he's able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day." Well, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about counting our blessings and then weighing them. You know, the old suggestion that you count your blessings in the midst of difficult times is a good one. And any realistic person will sit down and begin to number his or her blessings is going to soon discover that they're too many. In fact, one might discover that they're so numerous that it's virtually impossible to literally name them one by one, as we often say. Even after the list is very long, we think we've made the last entry on that list of our blessings, we realize that we've left something out. And there's something else we've got to add to that list of blessings. And Job encountered this problem in the book of Job. I call it a problem with quotation marks around it. When he attempted to make the count while he was in the midst of great distress, of counting his blessings. Think about that situation that Job was in. He said, "I would seek unto God, and unto God would I commit my cause, which doeth great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number, who gives rain upon the earth and sendeth waters upon the field, to set up on high those that be low, that those which mourn may be exalted to safety." Job chapter 5, verses 8 through 11. And in chapter 9, verse 10, "which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number." He's talking about God. But some pessimists may begin to argue that his list of problems is equally long to your list of blessings. What then? Well, when he compiles his list of problems, he's always able to think of one more to add to the list of those problems. You'd have a difficult time convincing him that his blessings outnumber his difficulties, and it would end up in a lengthy debate about those things. Because every person can find a problem. We can do that, but both lists would, like the Energizer Bunny, keep on going and going and going, that kind of thing. And simply counting the items on those two lists may not be enough to bring relief to some who are dedicated to the proposition that problems are things to nurture. And a lot of people delight in telling you all of their problems. And blessings are things to minimize. No, we've got it upside down if that's the way we're doing. If we're magnifying our problems and minimizing our blessings, we're looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. It'd be a helpful thing if we could discipline ourselves to compare our problems with our blessings and to assign some value or some weight to each one compared with the other, if we could do that. If we'd make a short list of our greatest blessings and compare that with our short list of worst problems, we'd soon find that our blessings outweigh our problems. I'm convinced of that. Paul was reckoning correctly, and by inspiration, when he measured the relative weight of the two, he said, "For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." Romans 8, verse 18. Paul was weighing the two, and he said, "Can't even compare them. You can't even compare them. I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory which shall be revealed." Well, Moses did that. He weighed the affliction that he suffered with the people of God and compared it with the reward that awaited him in heaven. The Bible tells us about that in Hebrews 11. He saw that the value of the eternal reward of outweighing these temporary afflictions he was having to undergo. And Moses did. We preached a lesson one time on the valleys in the life of Moses. We often think of Moses and the mountaintop experiences. I can only think of two mountaintop experiences. One was Mount Sinai and the other was Mount Nebo, where he died. And there was a whole lot of valleys in the life of Moses. But look at how Moses, look at his attitude, look at how he looked at things. He weighed the affliction that he suffered with the people of God, and he compared it with the rewards that awaited him in heaven. He said there's no comparison. He saw the value of the eternal reward outweighing the temporary affliction. And he looked at others with their lands of gold, as we sometimes sing. And he thought that Christ had promised him wealth untold. Well, he had access to that. He'd grown up in the house of Pharaoh. Everything that Pharaoh had, Moses had access to. He weighed that against the spiritual blessing that he saw in the future, and he realized that money can't buy his reward in heaven. Can't do that. Or his home on high, as we sometimes say. Moses was able to see that, and that's recorded for our learning. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of reward. Hebrews 11, verse 24 through 26. So when you trade your worst problems for your greatest blessings, would you make that trade? Would you make that kind of a trade? Would you give up the promise of eternal life for the eradication of your temporary grief or pain that you're undergoing? Would you trade that? Would you exchange your life and life of luxury for having a flat tire, to avoid having a flat tire? Well, those are things that are annoying to us. They happen to us. Would you give up the love of your family in exchange for a day without disrespect or kindness from others? Well, we're weighing something really heavy there against something that's really a light affliction. And it belongs on that list of light afflictions. Would you trade, and you can fill in this blank here, for the removal of, and you can fill in that blank, blessing versus problem. Would you trade this blessing for this problem? No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't do that. Your blessings always outweigh your problems. And for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are not seen are the things... We look at the things that are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So Paul had it right, Moses had it right, and if we follow them, we'll get it right. We need to do that. Well, that kind of sums up some things that we wanted to talk about tonight. I hope they were beneficial to you. A little bit different than some of the things we've talked about. There's some things that we'll be discussing in the near future that are difficulties in life today. The subject of suicide, assisted suicide, that's more in the news, and more people are participating in that. And a lot of times you never know until it happens. So that's something we need to discuss from a biblical standpoint, and we want to do that in the near future. Tonight, if you haven't obeyed the gospel of Christ, you need to consider the spiritual blessing that is at your disposal. All you have to do is lay hold of it. The Lord has offered it to you. I won't say he offered it to you on a silver platter, but essentially, if you compared the two, it's that kind of a blessing. There's still something to do. We need to embrace it. The Lord has offered salvation. It's a free gift, but there are conditions attached to it, as is just about anything that has value to it. There are conditions. I've often illustrated several years ago when I lived in Kentucky, we had a lady in the congregation that won a new car at the county fair. It was a free gift. She was excited. We were excited for her. But she had to meet some conditions. She had to have the right number on her ticket that she used to enter the fair, and they pulled her number out of the box. She had to have the right number. She had to fill out some papers. Imagine having to do that. to get a free car. She had to sign some papers. And she had to make sure it was insured before she drove it off the lot. There were some things she had to do. It was still a free gift. And salvation is like that too. It's a free gift, but there are some conditions. The Lord wants to know who really wants it and who doesn't care. And so I've often said he wants an RSVP from us. He wants a response from us, and we don't have to guess at what that response is. He has told us what it is. And that's through faith in him and obedience to his will, repenting and being baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of our sins, then we meet those conditions. And salvation is a free gift for us. Jericho was a free gift to the Israelites. He said, "See, I have given into your hands Jericho." They hadn't received it yet. They hadn't marched around the walls yet, but it was already a free gift. It was there. All they had to do was take it and meet the conditions the Lord gave, and then they had it. This evening, if you haven't obeyed the gospel, it would be a wonderful thing if you would do that. I don't know anything particularly outstanding about January the 12th on the calendar. It may be somebody's birthday, and if it is, I'm not meaning to slight you. But it's not a holiday. It's not a particular day on the calendar that we think of. But it could be worth marking on your calendar as the most important day in your life if you chose to obey the gospel on this day. That would be worth remembering. Tonight, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, will you come as we stand and sing the hymn that's been selected for your encouragement?